Hello and welcome to episode 10 of The Backside of Water, a podcast devoted to the rich history, awesome stories, and fascinating details behind your favorite Disney attractions. I'm Alex Stewart.
And I'm Harrison Ownby. On this episode, we are covering an attraction that we've mentioned in both the New Orleans Square episode as well as the Pirates episode, the Blue Bayou.
Yes, indeed, folks, that amazing eatery nestled amongst the shops and bodegas of New Orleans Square.
Excuse me, gentlemen. Oh, hey, I didn't see you sitting there. Who might you be?
I'm the attraction purist. You mean you don't know me from my e-books?
Should we?
Well, the books are pretty underground. You probably haven't heard of them. I wrote the Attraction Purist's Guide to Disneyland in 2014, and my follow-up, Underground Disneyland Trivia, you probably haven't heard of them.
Sorry, dude, I can't say I've read either one of those.
Not surprising. I thought it my duty to tell you guys that the Blue Bayou restaurant does not make the list in my ebook, Purist's Guide to Disneyland. It is clearly a restaurant and should not be featured on your show if you want to consider your podcast a show about your favorite Disney attractions.
Wait, where did you say you came from?
Oh, I was just leaving my studio where I record my podcast, Historical Errors and Epcot's World Showcase. You know, Disney parks really gloss over the squalor of peasant life in the 15th century.
Sounds real neat.
Al, who gave the attraction purist a microphone? Excuse me, but no one understands me.
Oh, okay, dude, calm down. Look, Harry and I discussed it, and we believe that the Blue Bayou is a landmark in Disneyland history. And it attracts a ton of people every single day.
You can't call something an attraction simply because it attracts people.
Man, this guy is going to hate our next episode about Club 33.
Clearly you don't know the definition of attraction. According to the Oxford English Dictionary...
Congratulations on knowing how to use a dictionary. We'll definitely take what you said to heart. Hey, go ahead and close the door on your way out.
Fine then, shun the concept of show purity. I don't care. I don't care at all. But this isn't the last time you've heard from the attraction purist.
Whew, that was rough. Folks, we hope that you don't mind that we're adding the Blue Bayou to our run. We personally believe that just like Trader Sam's Enchanted Tiki Bar, the Blue Bayou is equal to an attraction in the fact that it has the amazing theming, crazy attention to detail, and pure Disney magic of any attraction in the park.
Exactly. Both Al and I have had some extremely magical memories created within the walls of this glorious restaurant, as I am sure many of you listeners have also. And for those who have never been to the Blue Bayou, hopefully this episode will encourage you to check it out next time you're in the park.
Oh, Harry, it sounds like they just called our name. Let's go grab our reservation and journey into the Blue Bayou. In order to understand the full story of the Blue Bayou, we have to understand a little more general Disneyland history. It was months before Disneyland was slated to open, and Walt had a cash flow problem. The enormous cost of creating the happiest place on Earth was too much for Wed to handle on their own. So at the request of Walt's brother, Roy Disney, they began wrangling partners and sponsors to help fund Walt's magical idea. Amongst these partners were what were known as lessees. These lessees essentially rented space in the park and were allowed to sell various goods like balloons and food. But from the outset, Walt was foreseeing major problems on the horizon with this lessee concept.
Walt had a grand and very specific vision for Disneyland that provided a seamless storytelling experience.
Toot toot.
I want a seamless experience, see? Quote unquote Walt Disney. Provided a seamless storytelling experience for guests. But the lessees had a lot of freedom to do what they wanted in regard to the quality of their products, as well as how they presented their booths, bodegas, and restaurants. The lessees' presentation very often clashed or downright contradicted what Walt envisioned in his seamless story idea.
The lessee model also caused a lot of angst between the different vendors, and certain lessees went all out in the spirit of competitiveness. Some lessees, like the owner of the Silver Banjo restaurant that resided in Frontierland at the time, even added bright, gaudy spotlighting to showcase themselves above their fellow lessees. These lights absolutely broke the theming and pulled people out of the experience.
This does not sound like the Disneyland we have all come to know and love. It sounds like some sort of strange Twilight Zone-esque Disneyland where all is fair in business and commerce. I was actually thinking it kind of sounds like the Pottersville version of Disneyland.
That's actually exactly the way it felt. And Walt Disney, as well as other guests, began to see it as a problem. Over time, guests began complaining that the quality of food service and the restaurant options in Disneyland were extremely subpar. Walt was disquieted by these complaints, but there wasn't much that he could do about it since he was bound by the contracts with these lessees. Thankfully, within the first decade of the park being open, some of the lessees' contracts expired, and Walt went to work taking control of those contracts in order to tame this feeling like a Wild West that was running rampant around the food service that existed in Disneyland at the time. Walt heeded the call of his hungry, dissatisfied guests and became determined to find a way to better provide better dining experiences for them.
Now, some may say, "Hey dudes, that is a ton of pointless information about food vendor contract disputes and various business mumbo jumbo."
Sorry, that voice was ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't know what that was. It was like Barney Gumble crossed with Pee Wee Herman.
It was a masterpiece. You deserve some sort of podcast award for that.
Well, I was also inspired by your cast member in the Pirates episode.
Wait, that wasn't me. That was a cast member.
Yeah, you remember?
No, that was a cast member. People.
Oh,
listen.
Oh.
Don't break
sorry.
The magic, Harry.
Dang it. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I broke the magic. That's like I need a little dunce hat or something.
Sorry,
that.
Folks. Disneyland is closed. Harrison broke the magic.
One man ruined the magic today. The park's closed. We'll give you all your money back. Anyway, Walt wanted to jumpstart Disneyland's food reputation, and he thought that he had the perfect idea. Walt turned his sights on the Enchanted Tiki Room. As we discussed in the Tiki episode, Wed was originally planning a fine dining and show experience for the Tiki Room, but decided to scrap the dinner and just keep the iconic bird show.
Thank heavens they kept those birds and scrapped the dinner. I personally don't know what I would do if the Tiki Room didn't exist. I think I would actually cease to exist myself. Besides, we can all live on Dole Whip floats anyway, right?
Despite the change in the Tiki Room, Walt managed to keep good food in Adventureland by installing the Tahitian Terrace next door to the Tiki Room, but it wasn't quite the upscale, fine dining experience that Walt knew Disneyland was severely needing. Walt needed a fresh, new location to create this one-of-a-kind dining experience he was envisioning. Enter New Orleans Square.
During the building of Pirates of the Caribbean, Wed came up with an idea to place a restaurant inside of the attraction. Walt drew theming inspiration for this new restaurant from a short film entitled The Blue Bayou.
Come on back someday, come what may to Blue Bayou.
That was originally created for the 1940 Disney film Fantasia. The story follows a lonely stork looking for friendship amidst the lonesome bayou. The piece was scrapped from the final cut of Fantasia for time constraint reasons, but released in a Disney series entitled Make Mine Music. It was decided that the restaurant would be named after the animation short and be themed after a remote location amongst the weeping willows of the Deep South.
Walt also decided to resurrect the dinner and show idea that was scrapped over at the Tiki Room. So the team went to work creating a wonderful stage show that was designed to awe and amaze guests. The show was set to be the Blue Bayou's main spectacle and was ready to roll out on opening day of the restaurant. But sometime in 1966, the Wed team had a dress rehearsal and a mock show for Walt and a small group of people. And after the show ended, Walt got up and declared that the show was going to be scrapped. He claimed that the show in this restaurant would be the meal and the atmosphere. So we have yet another abandoned dinner and show attempt.
I think Walt knew what he was doing, but I would have loved to see that show.
What if it was an adaptation of Tennessee Williams' hit play, A Streetcar Named Desire, in which the main character ends up yelling the immortal line, "Stella!" from atop a guest's table?
Hey, Stella!
If it was anything like what you just did there, I can kind of see why Walt scrapped it.
It probably was. But if you think about it, the bayou section of the Pirates of the Caribbean attraction sets the tone for the rest of the ride, juxtaposing the quiet bayou with the boisterous pirates. I think a show at the Blue Bayou would be a little bit of a distraction.
Toward the end of 1966, both the restaurant and the attraction were on their way to becoming a rousing success. But unfortunately, tragedy struck the project. Walt Disney had been plagued with chronic, severe pain from an old polo injury for most of his adult life, and was going in for another surgery to try to relieve some of the pain caused by the injury. On November 2, 1966, he underwent a preoperative x-ray to make sure everything was on track for the surgery. But before the procedure, doctors called Walt in to inform him that the x-ray had revealed a large malignant tumor that had spread throughout his left lung. Doctors removed the lung and gave Walt 6 months to 2 years to live. Walt took a break from all of his projects in order to recover and undergo various treatments to try to extend his life. But on November 30th, Walt collapsed in his home. He was admitted to the hospital where he would spend his final days meeting and dreaming with family, friends, and coworkers. But sadly, only 10 days after his 65th birthday, the cancer got the best of him, and Walt Disney passed away at 9:30 a.m. on December 15th, 1966.
I always get sad relearning about Walt passing away. I know, you know, we talk about it. We've talked about it a lot in this podcast about New Orleans Square because he passed away like right in the middle of it. But it's amazing to see how much chaos it really sent like through the Haunted Mansion and the Blue Bayou and Club 33, everything. All the Imagineers that were working on all those attractions and restaurants really didn't know what to do afterwards. And also the Dream Suite that was supposed to be Walt's apartment but turned into a luxury suite for an insurance company for a while. It was just a weird time, and nobody really knew what to do. And I think Walt, he didn't tell a lot of people that he was sick, so people thought he was tired or something like that, and it was really unexpected.
Well, and I think one of the things that's amazing about the whole story is it really does show the absolute complete involvement that Walt Disney had in every single aspect of the company. I think that modern day companies, there really aren't any people like Walt Disney who obsessively are connected with every single project coming out of there.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's amazing, to see that all of these people that were involved in various projects, whether it was at Disneyland, whether it was down in Florida with the Florida project, or if it was at the studios, everybody was kind of thrown into this complete unknown because they had relied so much on Walt Disney. And it's amazing to see that one guy was able to balance and juggle all of the things that he did.
Yeah, and to recruit the people that he did for the tasks that they did. You know, those people that he recruited a lot of times didn't even think that they could do the job that he put them up for. And that's something that I've heard from a lot of people that worked with Walt, was that his biggest talent was he was the world's greatest casting director.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, and I think that that's one of the things that's so incredible about Disneyland itself is the fact that I was watching a storyboarding documentary with my film students because they're learning how to storyboard. And it was talking about all of these different great Disney animators like Wooly Reitherman, who you see these guys who are great animators, and Walt Disney uproots them from the thing that they're best at to say, hey, we're going to make a theme park together. And you don't have that now, where you have these people who are extremely talented in one area, and then you have this visionary pick them up and put them into something that's so far beyond what their skill set is, yet there's something incredibly magical about it because it worked, and it worked amazingly. And it makes you wonder if that lack of skill in that certain area is what truly brings the innovative magic that early Disneyland was pretty much known for.
Yeah, if you think about the scope of Disneyland, or of Disney in general, the studios, the parks, and everything, it takes so much vision to get all those people working on one thing, and especially artists, you know, because they're inherently, they do their own thing because they're artists, you know?
I don't know. We digress, but I think it's really good information to talk about, because these are things that I think a lot of people poo-poo Walt Disney about, is, oh, he's just this pop artist. He's really nothing but fluff. But in the end, the guy he deserves the credit that he gets from a lot of people, because he was an amazingly broad and innovative guy that a lot of people relied on solely for his creative vision on each project.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, Disney kind of went into a dark phase after this. You know, the 70s and the 80s, like, there really aren't that many enduring Disney classics that came out of that time, even the 90s. I think it started to find its legs again with Pixar and John Lasseter and that crew. But between Walt's passing and that, it was a lot of confusion and a lot of like, okay, how do we, you know, what makes us different from, like, and then Nickelodeon came into the scene, and it's like, what makes Disney different?
Oh yeah.
And now they have a clear vision, but then it was kind of jumbled.
Well, and I think one of the biggest indicators of that is The Jungle Book. It was the last animated feature that Walt Disney directly worked with, and that movie is phenomenal, yet there's just something that almost feels melancholy about the movie itself, and it also feels like there's a very abrupt ending. And I don't know if that was by design, but it seems like with Disney's amazing storytelling that they had coming out of the studio at that time, to see a movie like The Jungle Book where it just kind of, it almost walked away instead of ending.
Yeah.
That it's pretty, yeah, pretty metaphorical for what was going on at that time, that the magic had kind of just walked away from all of these different projects and left people completely confused.
Although I think the ending of The Jungle Book, I thought that as a kid too. I was like, why doesn't he stay in the jungle with Baloo? I would do that forever, not some stupid girl. But I get that, like, the second he sees a human girl, it's just like, I feel like I need to be here. This is where I belong. And yeah, as an adult, I appreciate that ending more. But
Well, and I don't necessarily know if it's the ending that I'm talking about. I guess I'm just talking more of the tone of the film. That it doesn't, as far as if we're going to nerd out and talk about, like, story structure, I think that the story structure, there's not a strong climax and a really solid resolution. Instead, it almost seems like a little bit of a jumbled climax. Like, they don't know exactly where it's going, what it's doing, and in the end, I still think it's a masterpiece. It's one of my favorite Disney movies, but I still think that it just kind of, there's that tone of it being incomplete.
Yeah, and there wasn't any mention of the girl before or anything. It does kind of seem like at the very end she's here and then he's gone. I hadn't thought about that, but so I guess getting back to Blue Bayou, the team came back to the skeleton of New Orleans Square and Blue Bayou, and they knew they had to complete their task, and they knew that would be what Walt would want them to do. So they made the final touches to the New Orleans Square area, the restaurant, and the accompanying attraction. And on March 18th, 1967, the world was introduced to the unmatched uniqueness of the Blue Bayou.
The experience when one walks through the doors of the Blue Bayou is best described on the back page of an original menu that was then known as the Blue Bayou Terrace. The following is an excerpt from that menu description.
Here in New Orleans Square, Walt Disney recreated many of the worlds that were old New Orleans. One of these worlds surrounds you now, the mysterious water wonderland of the bayous. Here, where Spanish moss drapes the live oak trees, where shrimp boats hide amongst the cypress, where a waterfront shanty stands in the shadow of a graceful antebellum mansion. Here are the strange sights of the Louisiana Bayou. The Blue Bayou Terrace is a world that knows no day. Moonlight shines here all day long. Nighttime is eternal.
This eternal night is one of the coolest things about the Blue Bayou. On any given day, you can move from the sweltering heat of Southern California into the cool, quiet Louisiana Bayou in a matter of about 10 steps. As you walk into the restaurant, you are greeted by a giant, sprawling tree. Does it look familiar? Well, it is the same variety of tree that the Swiss family Robinson built their treehouse in, the famous Disney Dendron. Now, this is no ordinary tree. It is based on a legendary tree known as the Dueling Tree.
The Dueling Tree? That sounds awesome!
Well, according to the menu description, it is a tree where many a New Orlean gets together to settle their affairs of honor.
So one might say this tree serves a dual purpose.
Monsieur, that joke offends my family and my honor. Prepare to meet by the tree.
The restaurant is also adorned with a piece of Disney history. In order to create New Orleans Square, Wed needed to tear down a famous Frontierland landmark, the Plantation House. This place was a fried chicken restaurant that ruled the roost in the area since the park opened back in 1955. Here you could get a fried chicken dinner for a whopping $1.60. They incorporated the entire front portion of the Plantation House into the one and only wall of the Blue Bayou restaurant.
And it completely works. It feels like you're eating on the lawn of a grand southern manor. On that very porch, from time to time, you can hear the jazz stylings of a solo guitarist strumming for patrons below. At other times, a full Dixieland jazz band will play rousing tunes for guests.
After all, it wouldn't be New Orleans without All That Jazz.
And all that jazz. Start the car. I know a whoopee spot where the gin is cold, but the piano's hot.
The ambiance and the music are great, but the food is where this little Cajun gym really shines. If you visited back in 1967, you could expect to find such delicacies as bœuf bourguignon. I actually learned that from the movie Julie and Julia, which is a great movie. You could get this dish for a massive $4, or I'm gonna butcher this, here we go. Poulet Baton Rouge, which was a boneless chicken leg stuffed with fluffy long grain rice, ham, onions, and mushrooms, served with baby shrimp and white wine sauce, all for $3. You could even, I know, isn't that insane? Well, here's the one thing that I was thinking about that I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's really super cheap. But the fact that it cost, in 1955, it cost $2.75 to get into the park. Now we see, I mean, fast forward 10 years, which really isn't long at all, and you see that this meal cost more than it cost to get into the park when it opened. I guess it kind of throws it back into a decent perspective that this place never was super cheap.
Yeah.
If it was the 60s or now, you would still be able to get the world-famous Monte Cristo sandwich. So for those who have never partaken in this decadent dish, it's thinly sliced turkey breast, ham, and Swiss cheese, and then they dip it into an egg batter and fry it to a golden brown. They then serve it with a compote of seasonal fruit. This sandwich is itself a Disney legend.
I love that sandwich. That description that you were telling me just makes me hungry.
I agree. And one thing that I've noticed is I've tried to have the Monte Cristo at other places. Like, for instance, my local Binnigan's, you know, the ones who are the blues busters, they have a Monte Cristo. I don't think that they have Binnigan's anymore, but I remember when I was at Binnigan's, I was like, ooh, the Monte Cristo.
Yeah.
And I ordered it, and that was a mistake. It definitely was the soggiest, most horrifying thing that I've ever put in my
mouth. It's tough to fry a ham sandwich and have it be good. Like, you know, and not have everything just be just disgustingly greasy.
I feel like both of those sentences pulled out of context. It's tough to really get a good fried ham sandwich, or it was the most soggy, disgusting thing I've ever put in my mouth. Either one of those, if they were just soundbited, would probably incriminate us for the next 5 years.
It would be put in the Red Band trailer for sure.
Oh, man. So the ambiance of this place really hasn't changed over the past 50 years, but the menu and those prices definitely have.
Yikes! I'm looking at the menu now. The food sounds amazing, but these prices make the $10 hot dog sound reasonable. Broiled filet mignon for $46? Or citrus marinated chicken breast for $35? Al, this place is more expensive than Chili's. For this fine dining experience, I would wear my special t-shirt, the one with no stains. That's right. The one I wore when I interviewed for a job at Radio Shack. That one.
Did you get that job, by the way?
No. I wasn't wearing the right size t-shirt.
Just a women's extra small.
Showed a little bit too much midriff for that one. Thought that was what they were looking for.
Oh, man. This episode has been just a complete sidetrack of us talking about the dumbest things in the world, but I don't regret it. I have no regrets.
I 100% regret it.
Okay, so like we've been saying, Walt wanted fine dining in Disneyland, and he got it, and the prices to go along with it. This is not a place one goes every time they visit the park. This is the kind of place you go with your honey when you want to show her a good time. In fact, this is the restaurant my wife and I ate after we got engaged on the Jungle Cruise. If you want to hear more about that story, well, then just go check out our Jungle Cruise episode. It's a celebration kind of restaurant, in my opinion.
I agree. Although, Al, let's be honest, we've had some pretty great man dates there.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, I remember we'd split a Monte Cristo and everything. We didn't go halfway at all.
We did
go halfway, but date-wise, we didn't.
Let's clarify that the reason why we split the Monte Cristo was not because of a romantic, but a financial reason. We got in there and were like, holy cow, these prices are ridiculous. Let's just split.
Wait, it wasn't romantic? Al? After all these years?
Harry, we need to talk.
Also, the Monte Cristo is pretty hard to finish alone because it's so rich.
Oh, there's the reason why they call it the Monte Cristo is because the Count of Monte Cristo was loaded.
The calorie count of the Monte Cristo is really high.
The calorie count of Monte Cristo.
1 calorie, 2 calories, 3 calories. 3 hours later, 540 calories, 541.
I'm sure nobody else finds this funny, but I thought that was one of the funniest things I've heard in a long time.
Yeah. We should have never gotten microphones. This is a bad idea.
I agree. Where are we even at here?
Well, we were talking about how lunch is a little bit easier on the pocketbook, but not by much. And as we said on the New Orleans Square episode, make sure to make reservations with the Blue Bayou as it is very hard to get in without them. You could even call a couple of weeks before your trip to ensure you're spot at a table in this famous Disneyland dining experience.
After 49 years, the sandwich, like this famous Disneyland eatery, is still a huge hit. The food scene in Disneyland has changed significantly over the past 60 years, and we have eateries like the Blue Bayou to thank for this change. The charm, elegance, and sheer magic of this restaurant showcase how Walt envisioned the quality of his park's food, and people are sure to be lining up around the building for many more years to come.
And that is the story of the Blue Bayou. Thanks so much for listening, folks. We had a great time making this episode, and just writing about the food made me gain almost 7 pounds.
The calorie count of Monte Cristo strikes again.
Put me in prison for 40 years.
And see how fat I come out. And folks, we didn't even get a chance to explore the other restaurants that the Blue Bayou has inspired, like the Blue Lagoon restaurant in Disneyland Paris, where you can dine on a sandy beach somewhere in a secluded area of the Caribbean.
Another life goal is eating at the Blue Lagoon and visiting Disneyland Paris.
I couldn't agree more, man. But that's all the time we have for this episode. Please be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram for companion photos to this episode. You should also subscribe to the show on iTunes so you can be the first to hear the maniacal rantings of the latest episode.
And if you can, take a few seconds to write us a review on iTunes. We always love to see what people have to say about the episode, and it also helps others hear about the show as well.
So until next time, as you exit, please watch your head and watch your step.
Thanks for putting up with us and our meanderings. And if you happen to miss your step and hit your head, please watch your language. Goodbye.